Access number 28650, Mr. Gordon Mellor, Reel 14. Now, we're talking about a typical raid. Now, what would you do in between raids, usually? We'll go on to some of the other raids later on, but what would you do, you know...
Well, in your spare time?
Yeah. I mean, how much... How long would you sleep for, you know?
Oh, well, on this sort of typical... This is largely summertime we're talking about from... shall we say May through to October. So again, I was fortunate in which we had good periods of weather. After the night after or the day after the raid, then, and perhaps as I said, a couple of games of snooker, we would then go off probably half past six, maybe seven in the morning, and sleep through to lunchtime.
So about 5 or 6 hours?
5 or 6 hours at the most. Yes, there was always somebody up round about midday, and everybody on the squadron didn't fly on every occasion. There was always some with US aircraft, or they were they'd been on 2 or 3 nights running and they were given a break. Very often, early in the lunch period, then whisper would go round that whether there was anything on that night or not, so that that took care of the mornings after the raid.
And if there wasn't anything happening, what would happen in the afternoon?
In the afternoon, we would be down at the flights. If aircraft were available, then. We would possibly go on an afternoon flight, and we're being introduced with the G-Box at that time. And whilst we practice it in a hut with several pieces of equipment on the ground, then it did not do much for us when we had to do it in actual fact. So now we used to go up and sort of fly around using the G-Box.
Tell me what the G-Box was and how it worked, because this is the first time we've mentioned that.
When we first went there, there was a week or two before we were introduced to it. I think they were just getting it fixed into the station practice place to become familiar with it. It was an oscilloscope, a box, something like a computer equipment these days, except that the picture you saw was round, and I would suppose it would be about 8 or 9 inches diameter, perhaps a little bit more, and there were three broadcasting stations scattered around the country. There was more than one set, but I'm just referring to just one set. There were three stations, A, B, and C. And on your circular screen, there was a horizontal line with divisions on it. And below it were two more. So you had one for each of the three stations. And on the line, when they were broadcasting, you would get a symbol come up which looked like a pole. The Felicia Beacon would be the nearest thing to, if you recall them. And as you passed over parts of the country, then of course your bearing to each of these three stations varied. And that was replicated on these three lines, and you read figures off from each line, and you then converted those figures onto the chart where the lines are all numbered.
Don't seem to be any hint.
Did you not?
But
no. This is a. A chart with lines in a graticule all over. Well, I thought I had one to show you, but
Never mind. I think I understand the principle.
Anyhow, there is they're all at an angle.
Was it difficult to grasp the principle of this?
Or was it
pretty easy once you'd had a couple of practices?
Yes. What you had to do was you had to measure the position of these poles on each of the three lines. You get a reading, and you then would plot. You get the reading. You'd actually make a click a switch so that the readings were all taken at the same moment. You didn't have to worry about position the movement of the aircraft at all. So you got three readings, which you then plotted onto your G chart, and then you could get a latitude and longitude, and you could plot that onto your Mercator chart. That's it.
And I can see one here, and it makes sense what you're saying. So if you did a flight that, now what would you do for the rest of the day if you weren't? A G flying training flight, perhaps?
Yes,
that came under training. What else might?
Only the pilots would have been involved in a test flight, so that didn't take much time. We used to get called out to do sea searches after a raid. If you hadn't been on, then you'd get called for.
Now, what's a sea search like?
What it involves usually. Sometimes it was one aircraft was given an area, and another aircraft was given an adjoining area. Sometimes you were on your own. Sometimes you flew as a flight of perhaps four, five aircraft. This was in response to SOS or other information that came through to some central depot, and they farmed it out to the squadrons and asked them to put a search up. And we'd be given, on a Mercator chart, we'd be given the latitude and longitude of the perimeter of the area we were to search. And you then take off, usually with the full crew, and you go out to this point somewhere in the North Sea, based on your navigation. If you were on your own, you would then say, right, we're here, we're going to search north and up and down the graticule of the Mercator chart, i.e. North and south. And you would fly up the one side. You would then turn at the top 90 degrees, and you would fly twice the visibility distance, so that when you turn again to fly a reciprocal course to your first leg, that you would then be just covering not the same area but the area adjoining it. So you would go up and down and progress to the east in this case we are describing, and eventually you get to the other extremity of your search area. You would then reverse that procedure and come back, and you'd go over that area four times. If everything you check the wind as much as possible, or you could do that by pushing out a smoke bomb. And the rear gunner would take a bearing on that as we went away from it, and it would give an indication whether the wind had changed much or not. And if you saw something, then there was a procedure to let people on the ground know. But unfortunately, we did it several times, and we never really found anything that was viable to call the lifeboats or anybody out. We did do it on occasion in formation, in which case each aircraft was supposed to be a certain distance apart, so that the aircraft flying side by side, you could see the whole of the space between you, which was, I suppose technically it was twice the visibility distance, providing it wasn't too great. If it was, amazing visibility, then you would fly at a distance at which you'd be able to see a dinghy or something in the ground, in the water.
Now, if you weren't, so what else, what would you do in the evening, you know?
There's another thing I did. Well, this happened in the evenings, in actual fact. I got to know the chap who ran the Link trainer. He was a flight sergeant. We're in the same mess, got talking. And he said, well, come along, let's go and have a go at it. So I said, oh, right. So there and then we sort of finished our drinks and we went down to the Link trainer. This was in his spare time, of course, as well. And he introduced me to it. And I'd already sort of been getting the odd 20-minute sort of practice in on straight and level flying. And he set me up on doing the exercises. And I went there quite a number of times during the period I was there, at least once a week, perhaps more.
And how did you do? I mean, how difficult was it?
It was very light on the controls. You know what they look like. They're sort of a mini fuselage on a platform, and it will go round in a circle. You can head it in any direction. You can head it up. You can head it down. You can tip the wings. You can do most of the exercises that are possible with a plane. You can't loop it. But I got on fairly well. I must say, I was did some of the exercises, and after a bit of practice, and doing it several times, different periods, then I used to put in a pretty fair effort, because he had a big table, and he had a crab, which recorded your movement over the ground, or a theoretical movement. So if he gave you a letter T, for instance, and he said, well, go around the perimeter of the tree, the T, like that, then the crab would plot your result down on the chart there. And yes, after some little practice, I sort of was quite commendably good at it. I never sort of got anywhere near doing a landing or doing a takeoff, anything like that. That was far too risky thing to approach. Yes.
Did you ever think of going for flying training? I suppose you could have done.
Well, I'd chosen in the navigator situation, and at that time there was no thought of it. You were on a ops, and you were doing what you were trained for.
Now, what was a sergeant's mess like?
Very comfortable, very comfortable. It was a big H-shaped building, such as we had experienced elsewhere. There was the dining room, obviously, which was a long sort of hall on one wing of the building, of the H, and from the middle section that where the cooks and the staff who operated the meals and what have you, they all worked there, and we had a series of waitresses. There were tables on either side of the hall, and bones on a fish bone, so on the spine of a fish bone, the tables were out like that, and they would probably sit it varied, about eight, I would say. Four on one side of the table and four side by side on the other, so that very often, depending on the time you went in, you would sit with some people you knew well. Sometimes if you were a bit late, then you sat with wherever there was a seat, and you got to know somebody else, and in the end you got to know everybody to nod to anyhow.
Was it much, I mean, there's a cliche of it, but was there much drinking going on in the mess, would you say? You weren't a big drinker, were you, Tim?
No, well, I had my pint, it seems everybody else did. Well, that took place on the other sort of line of the H, the other bang of the H. There was an entrance hall in the front of the, and you sort of go in there. There was cloakroom. There was armchairs and what have you, drawing room style, And of course there was the snooker and darts, and some people wanted to play chess, some people wanted to play cards, and there was provisions for it, or there was a writing room where people just went in and they were quiet and they wrote letters home or to whatever their fancy was. It was yes, I thought it was a very acceptable form of life.
Now, would you ever get out from Elsenwold? I mean, would you go for a drink in the nearest?
Oh yes.
I mean, what is the nearest town? Is it
nearest pub was in the village. It was called the Railway Tavern, I think, or just the Railway. It still exists. I don't know whether the beer's the same or not. Probably isn't. But it's got a new signboard to what it had in those days, and it is right opposite the entrance to the railway station. And we used to go down there. It was we used to go down as a crew very often, perhaps once, twice a week, depending on flying. And
what was it night like?
It was crowded, smoky, as you might guess. And I expect in the morning when the landlord went down and opened the doors, he gave seized a breath of a relief, because it probably was a very beery smell. But we used to sort of pay for a round each. And when we'd gone round the crew, we went back.
So about 4 or 5 pints?
Well, sometimes it's half pints, but yes, you'd probably have a couple of 3 pints. And after having had an evening meal with a fair amount of food in you, the walk back, you were still feeling pretty good when you got back. Trouble was if you tried to repeat that when there were 7 or 8 of you in a crew. I'm not quite sure how we got by with that, but we each paid for a round, even if it was only half pints, and then we sort of paid our whack. And the walk back from the railway was quite strenuous, because it was down, the railway station was down in the valley with the Ladnock village, and it was all uphill the whole way, and it was quite steep, some of it. So that rather sort of settled you down from bed. Other times there was a cinema. Sometimes there was a camp concert with what did they call them? With the professionals.
ENSA,
yes, that's right. Yes, my wife went round with ENSA on one or two places. That's right. Yes, I remember she went to Hemswell, I think it was, on one occasion. And she certainly came to other camps round and the Midlands. And she went with Tommy Hanley and the whole party up to entertain the fleet up in North Scotland, Scapel Flow, I think it was. But they were good. They really were. They put a good effort in, especially when you've got well-known theatrical people there. Some of them were beginners, but then when you've got perhaps 10 acts or something like that on in the evening, then they weren't all first class, but they were very entertaining as a whole.
Now, that's sort of generally the basics of what life was like there. Now, you'd arrived at a very concentrated part, didn't you? Because they were just starting the 1,000 bomber raids.
That's right.
There's the first one, which was on the 30th of May.
Yes.
And then there's one on the 1st of June. Yes. I think it is.
Yeah.
Which is Essen.
Yes.
I don't know whether you remember any of these particularly, or it says heavy flak there. I mean,
Essen, of course, was the centre of Krupps, steelworks and what have you. The defences there were pretty strong, and you, the Ruhr itself, you come up the valley, and there was a sort of a more or less at right angles. There was another stretch of towns and factories, like your reverse figure seven. And Cologne was about halfway up the vertical leg. That was, yeah, it was fairly light sort of flak, plenty of that, and there was some heavy flak too. Whether they were expecting us or not, I don't know. Our aiming point was the Cathedral Square.
Hang on, is that at Cologne? Or
that was at Cologne,
yeah.
Yes. Coming back onto Essen, then it was very much heavier there. Different kettle of fish altogether.
What was the flak like? How much worse was it?
I would say it was probably, yes, 60-70% stronger than we'd experienced at Cologne. Perhaps a bit more. Difficult to assess from this distance now. We had also to Bremen, I think that was one of the thousand raids, and about a month later we also had another thousand raid. I've got a feeling that was back. I might think that was back to Bremen again.
The Bremen ones, the 25th of June, was one of them.
Oh yes. Yes.
So these raids were in the pattern. He said, "There's one thing that is. It says attacked by Ju-88 on Belgian coast. This is after the raid on Essen on the 8th of the 6th. Do you remember that at all?" Or it's just in the log, but you don't seem to remember that so much. Perhaps you didn't. It says aircraft hit in several places.
Though. Yeah, I think we gave them the slip. I think we must have given them the slip. I haven't got much memory of that.
It's 60 years ago. So anything on the Bremen raid? Anything on, you know, just, I mean, these are just raids, and
The pattern, the routes are different, but the patterns were very similar. And the only other main difference, of course, was the timing. If you were going to Emden or something like that, then you would go over the North Sea and then cut in from the coast to Emden, which was in a big inlet on the left-hand side, and you could approach the target point from across water to a certain degree. Bremen, of course, was inland, and you had to find the target there. It wasn't so easy. We went to Kassel. In actual fact, on that trip, I'm not sure whether it was on the way in or on the way out, we passed over one of the dams which subsequently Gibson and his colleagues attacked. But it wasn't any, I saw the dam there from about 15,000 feet. It was quite clear on a bright night. But we had no connection with it other than just passing on to our target.
One thing that's notable is on the 13th or 18th of June.
Sorry,
you go mine laying, which is a different fall. I mean, was that that's obviously that's off the Frisian coast?
Yes.
Do you remember anything about the mine laying business?
In particular, no. It didn't mean that you had to fly at a certain height to drop the mine. If you flew too high, then it might well not go into the right position, or it might actually break up on impact with the sea. So there was a heightened speed indications that you had to follow. You could possibly run into an armed trawler. They had parading up and down the islands there to add a bit of protection, but unless you happen to run straight over one, then on the occasions we went, I don't recall us having any trouble. We saw some bursts of flak and light flak, but We were quite close to the sea level. I can't recall us being worried about it. When we used to think, well, that was one of the easier trips.
Now, then there seems to be an interruption in your tour. I don't know whether there's anything, but that those are the raids in June.
Oh,
there
yes.
There seems to be an interruption while the squadron converts from Wellington to Handley
Page,
right. Halifax. Is
yes.
It? Now, when does that happen? That looks like July. I'm not sure about that. It doesn't say.
Yes, it is July, largely. I sort of missed those. This was all done a long time ago in the book here, but it certainly was in July, and the squadron were taken nominally out of active service, but I rather fancy there were some raids still going on, but the Wellingtons were flown out. I think we had one Halifax came in to start with. So we saw what we were going to get, and then within a very short time all the Wellingtons had gone, and I think I'm right in saying that the conversion flight was formed out of sea flight. I think it was, we had three flights, so it left us down to two, and that flight I think was used to make up the conversion unit, using some of the long service pilots, yes, mainly warrant officers, I think, and there was a squadron leader in charge of the conversion unit. So the pilots got training in all the intricacies of a four-engined aircraft, and the crews were scattered around the country. A number of the wireless operators were flown up to Bossiemouth. I navigated one of the, yes, I think it was the first time I went into Halifax. I acted as navigator, and we took the wireless operators up there, and it caused a bit of a stir in Bossiemouth. There was this big aircraft, four engines. It was the first most people had seen up there, so I think it was Squadron Leader Holford was the pilot. I'm not sure. He had an armed guard put on it, and we then disembarked and went over to the mess. I think we probably had lunch there or something of that style, and the there was an armed guard on the plane all the time we were away from it, and we just took it up and came back again. In a similar situation, I got posted to 102 Squadron at Pocklington. They were already on Halifaxes, and I got a bit more experience with flights there.
Now that's practicing in the use of G from the looks
of
it.
Oh yes, with some of it, yes, that was all take part of it. I mean that is not a navigation method really, it's an aid to navigation. Although you could navigate with it as long as you were in an area where it wasn't jammed.
So this was with 102 Squadron you were attached
to? I think it was 102, yes.
And that's at Pocklington in Yorkshire?
Yeah, yes.
Anything happened there or anything
no,
remote?
No. They wouldn't take me on ops. I wasn't part of their establishment. But I did get a number of flights there. It was useful, and I was taken over there by plane, dropped off, and they were expecting me, and there was accommodation laid on, and in due course an aeroplane was on an exercise, I suppose, and came down, and I was waiting and hopped on and was taken home back to Elsham.